All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Buddy Huggins, and we're going to be talking to a wrestling living legend in just a few minutes. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. This is the Buddy Huggins Show, Lycos Talk Radio, also on the internet. Also, this will go up on various, as we say, radio talk shows around the country. And my guest tonight is definitely a living legend. His name is Gary Hart.
Well, Buddy, it's nice to be on your show tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. I've been an admirer of yours for many, many years, and I remember you very well coming through Mississippi and the old Mid-South Territory.
Yeah, I used to like to go there for George Calkin in Jackson, Mississippi. It was one of the best seafood restaurants I had ever eaten in. And George Calkin was a great guy. I loved wrestling for him, the Spoiler. Used to love to go there and wrestle for him, too.
Yes, sir. George and Gil Calkin, out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. I know them very well.
Yeah, nice people.
Mm-hmm. They got their talent primarily from the Leroy McGirt territory.
Yes, they were. Their talent was booked out of the Mid-South office, but occasionally George Calkin and Bill Watts would contact me at their world class. For talent, because our TV overlapped there on World Class, and also I was fortunate enough to be one of the early members on WPBS over on Peachtree Street in the early 70s, mid-70s. So we used to go into the Mid-South for Watts and also for Leroy McGirt, but I did most of my business with Bill Watts in those days.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How did you actually get interested and involved in the world of professional wrestling?
Well, my uncle, Billy Gales, was the booking agent for Fred Kohler in Chicago for many, many years. He was a junior heavyweight champion, and growing up with an uncle in the business, I spent a lot of my free time at the Marigold Arena and the amphitheater in Chicago and any of the local shows they ran. I'd drive my uncle crazy to take me to the matches with him, and as it happens in most families, that if your dad's a bricklayer or a mechanic or a race car driver or a truck driver, you sort of have an affinity to follow in their footsteps. I didn't have a dad. He left right before I was born, so my Uncle Billy was more or less my father figure, and I think he did a hell of a job.
Yes, sir.
And I started in 1960 at the Marigold Arena in Chicago, and also wrestled in the amphitheater in Chicago and Milwaukee, Des Moines, Dubuque, all those areas around there when it was territorial wrestling. So I had some very good schooling, and I was fortunate enough to be with some of the big name wrestlers out of New York, because they would bring wrestlers in from New York at that time, such as Buddy Rogers and Angelo Poffo, Bobo Brazil, the Kangaroos, and I could go on and on, but most of these people that on your show, they probably wouldn't recognize those names, and I don't want more people too much.
Well, these fans that listen to this radio talk show, they're quite familiar with most of those names. Yeah. A lot of people are looking back. The product today is not holding up to near about what you guys did.
Well, I don't know if that's true, Buddy. I think, you know, you can look back at the generation that I was in. I started, like I said, in 1960, and I wrestled actively until 1974 when I was unfortunate enough to crash in Tampa Bay along with Austin Idol and Buddy Colt and Bobby Shane. Bobby died that night, February 20th, and after that I got into the managing more. I managed earlier in my career, but in 75, after the crash, I really wasn't capable of performing to the level that I had before, but I have nothing bad to say about modern-day wrestling. I think you know, everything changes. Baseball's changed, basketball's changed, all sports have to evolve along with the people that buy the tickets, and if you don't, you'll be end up be like World Championship Wrestling in Atlanta, you know. So I only have kudos and bouquets for people that are into WWF. I'm not one of those guys that say, well, my time was better than their time. I have a lot of respect for them, but had a lot of respect for the people that I was associated with also in my career.
Yes, yes, most definitely. The crash that you mentioned, Austin Idol was on that plane crash.
Yeah.
And his career did not stop. He kept on going for a few more years. I know he got together with in Memphis territory with Jerry Lawler and had some Jimmy Boogie Woogie Man Valiant.
Yeah, Jimmy Valiant, the Boogie Woogie Boy. Made a lot of money wrestling him throughout the Carolinas when I was when I had the great Kabuki with me. The odd thing about Austin Idol, he had really never made a big name in wrestling until after the crash, because he was weighing in about 320 pounds the night we went into the bay. And after the accident, he got into turning down, and he developed himself a pretty good persona, you know, as Austin Idol, and he clicked. But up until that time, Austin had just been, you know, a struggling young wrestler. And once he was in the crash, he couldn't train as hard for quite a while, and he lost a tremendous amount of weight, and he had a completely different look about himself that the people picked up on, and they liked him. He was very good for a short period of time.
Definitely. The you mentioned world class.
Yes.
You spent most of your career in world class?
Oh, no. I spent off and on. My career spanned from the beginning. Chicago, which was a booking office at the time, that you would wrestle throughout the Midwest. And then after that, I went to Detroit, and I wrestled there for a gentleman by the name of Bert Ruby. For quite a few years. Then I went into West Texas for Doc Serpolis and Dory Funk Sr. And then after that, I went into the Dallas booking office. At the time, it wasn't called World Class. And then I left for 7 years. I went to Australia for Jim Barnett and was a booking agent for him, and managed quite a few of the top guys that I would bring from America over to Australia. I was there from 69 to 74 off and on. I came back and forth through Dallas, but it by no means was that the place that I spent most of my time. I guess because of World Class TV, a lot of people assumed that.
That's exactly why I said it, because the TV, like you said, overlapped the Mid-South territory, and I was fortunate. I was able to see World Class, also Mid-South, and also Memphis Championship, you know, the old Memphis Wrestling. So I was in a real good place right here in Central Mississippi to see a lot of talent come through.
Well, the good thing about the fortunate thing about myself here in Dallas at the time, we had a TV station, KTVT, which was a real strong cable, similar to Atlanta, not as large, but covered a large portion of the Southwest. Ironically enough, it sold and it became an NBC station with Channel 11 now. But that was a great venue to showcase a lot of talent. And then, as I said, I was fortunate early on to be involved with Jim Barnett. When he left Australia, he went to Atlanta and took over TBS and Georgia Championship Wrestling. So I was fortunate enough to be one of the earlier guys on TBS early on, say in 74, 75, along with the Road Warriors and guys like that, that got a lot of national exposure and really helped our careers all around.
Yeah, that was the first glimpse of national exposure for most people in the United States to see big time wrestling.
Yeah, like I said, I was on KQVK out of Channel 11 every Saturday night. It was a 90-minute wrestling show. I think it was the longest running wrestling show up until that time. It was something like 20 some years it had been on, and when I went to Atlanta, I really had a good break because TBS, at the time was called WTBS, it had just went up on the satellite. Ted Turner took a chance to put his TV up there, and I think he was the first one to do that, to send his signal up by satellite. So that was very fortunate for myself and the talent that I managed for all those years.
Yes, sir. He was a genius way ahead of his time. That man, he knew what the industry was headed for.
We talking about Barnett, or are we talking about Ted Turner?
Ted Turner, and he knew a good product when he seen it, and he was watching what the Crocketts were doing.
Yeah.
He was watching what Bill Watts was doing, and he kind of put it all together, and it became WCW.
Well,
now before I jump to WCW, let me back up and talk about Texas just a little bit more.
Sure.
Dory Funk Sr., you mentioned him earlier.
Yes.
He seems to be a key pivotal for a lot of people that came through the Texas Amarillo area.
Well,
was he actually a big-time promoter in the early years, like the 40s and the 50s?
No, I think Senior was very fortunate. You know, a lot of times you cross paths with other people and you start a jail. There was a promoter there by the name of Doc Serpolis that was a very big-time promoter for a small area. And Senior became quite adept at spotting young talent, people that would have a great future in wrestling. And he demanded a lot of you, you know. I mean, he would never book you against somebody that was not going to give you one hell of a match. But Dory Funk Sr., I can't say enough good about him. He was a great man, and he really loved wrestling. His two children turned out to be world champions, Dory and Terry. I mean, he was a great guy. I either can't say anything bad about him.
How did he fit into the picture with the Houston Paul Bosch area?
Okay, see, at this time in wrestling, it was territorial. Amarillo had a booking office that supplied talent to Albuquerque, to Lubbock, to Midland, to Odessa, to Abilene, to Plainview, towns in that West Texas area. And then there was a gentleman by the name of Ed McLemore that had Dallas and Fort Worth and the TV rights to KTV TV, the large cable station. And then Frank Brown and Dorothy Livingood had the TVs in San Antonio, Corpus Christi, Brownsville, and Matamoros and Harlingen. And then Mr. Bosch had Houston, which was the plum of Texas wrestling. He had the TV contracts there. At that time in wrestling, no one person controlled everything. There was a lot of different promoters that controlled their own TV and their own booking offices.
You mentioned Dallas.
Yeah.
When did Fritz actually take control of the Dallas territory?
Well, I don't know if he ever had control of anything other than the Dallas-Fort Worth market, because in those days, like I said, Frank Brown and Dorothy Livingood were in San Antonio, which encompassed South Texas. Paul Bosch had a Houston, and the area there, like Galveston, places like that, and then the Funks and Doc Serpolis had the Panhandle area. I think Fritz's strongest run probably was something along when his business really took off, when the Dallas market really took off, was when World Class began. And if I remember right, I would say that would have been around 76 or 7, maybe 77, 78 is when Dallas really became the big thing in Texas.
And you were actually there.
Oh, I was there. Yeah. Yeah. You
seen it get big.
Yeah. Well, see, and like I said to you, in 1975, I crashed in Tampa Bay. and I could no longer wrestle. And I went to Atlanta to be a booking agent and a TV producer for Jim Barnett. And I had stayed there for a couple of years, and when I left there, I was invited in by Ed McLemore and Paul Bosch to be a booking agent and a TV producer for them. And world-class TV was actually, and I don't want to sound egotistical, but that was created by a gentleman by the name of Mickey Grant, Bill Mercer, and myself. We were the ones that had the concept that we wanted full sound microphones on the turnbuckles and under the rings. We wanted to dispel the myth that wrestlers don't go out there and talk continuously throughout the match. And we had the idea of having handheld cameras so you could have close-ups, which had never been used in wrestling. They always used a hard shot and a long shot and then maybe one other camera. I mean, it was being done with three cameras at most, but when World Class was conceived, they did it with six and seven cameras. So I was a very big part of the beginning part of World Class and the World Class tape.
And it was some of the best footage. I tell you, I enjoy it immensely. You seem to have managed quite a few different type of characters. You mentioned the great Kabuki.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to follow you from there to different territories.
Oh well, when I had a wrestler with me, I took very good care of them. That's why I had the longevity that I had in wrestling. But I also took care of people like Michael Hayes and Terry Gardy. I'm the one that put Buddy Roberts with them to make for a six-man. I had Bruiser Brody. I was his booking agent for many, many years off and on. Sometime he loved me, sometime he hated me, sometime I wrestled against him, and sometime he wrestled for me. But I was always on the look for a lot of talent, like a guy King Kong Bundy. I'm the one that found him in Atlanta, Georgia.
I mean, King Kong Bundy?
Yeah, I was
the one that
developed King Kong Bundy and brought him to national prominence. Quite a few guys. The Great Muta was another one. Dickie Slater was another one. Bob Orton was another one. Don Jardine, the Sparler, was another one. Brute Bernard, Skull Murphy. You know, I could go on, but I don't want to bore you.
You just mentioned some great, great names. Don Jardine stands out heads and shoulders above a lot of folks.
Yeah, he was actually.
That man could wrestle his tail off, and I so much enjoyed him. I want to interview him, and I want to get that here in the next, you know, not too long future. But
mm-hmm.
I've got so many people that I want to interview. You mentioned Dick. You mentioned Dick Slater.
Yes, Dickie Slater was one of my boys for many, many years.
Tough guy.
Yeah, another guy, Pak Song, a big Korean that I had for many, many years. Professor Tanaka was another guy that traveled with me. Bobby Duncombe, you know, I learned very early, Doug, that he who controls the talent controls his own destiny. And I found out early in life that if you had one or two wrestlers working with you or for you, you had a little bit of power. But if you had a half a dozen, you had a whole lot of power because you controlled four or five matches on the card. You could demand better positioning on the TV. You could demand better pay from the arena, a better cut. In my day, you know, a lot of guys would get 8%, but me and my boys always got 14%. Because I controlled four or five guys in every area that I ever went to.
Yes, yes. Someone that had a stable at about the same time you did, and I know you two had to meet, was Skandar Akbar.
Well, oddly enough, and him and I were never in the same area at the same time. A couple of times I was in Mid-South when he was there with Kamala and I had Kabuki, and that was an automatic sellout that people wanted to see that. So on certain occasions I was in areas that he was at, but never for long periods of time because, like I said, I was a greedy type guy. You know, I wanted my boys taken care of, and I didn't want to compete with somebody else with four or five guys either, you know. So.
And you had so many options.
Yeah, well, in those days, there was like the Carolinas for Jim Crockett Sr. There was Australia for Jim Barnett. There was San Francisco for Roy Scheer. There was L.A. for Mike LaBelle. You know, there was St. Louis for Sam Muchnick, who never would use me, said I was too violent. But I mean, there was like 16 or 17 real good places that you could make a good living, and there was about five or six that you could make a great living out of.
Did you ever make your way to New York to Vince Sam?
No, I used to do a lot of business with Vince's father, Vince Sr. Not wrestling, but a lot of talent like Ivan Koloff I took from New York to go to Australia with me, Dominic DiDucci, Antonio Pugliese, Baron Cicluna, guys like that. I was the one that sent George Animal Steel there. I was the guy that sent the Ultimate Warrior. He was here with me as the Dingo Warrior, and he ended up there as the Ultimate Warrior. But Bobby Heenan pretty much had that sewed up in Lou Albano, and I felt that they could have New York. I'd take the rest of the country.
There you go. Well, the South is one of the greatest places to be from and to have grown up watching wrestling. You mentioned Terry Gordy and Michael Hayes.
Uh-huh.
I remember how they did this thing with a feud with the Von Erichs,
mm-hmm.
and it lasted for 8 months. It had to go somewhere, so it went to Texas Stadium. What year was that? 1984?
I think the first big crowd at Texas Stadium was King Kong Bundy against Fritz Von Erich on Fritz's retirement match. And then I would say the Birds, quite a few big Texas Stadium shows, quite a few.
I remember one being 42,000.
Yeah.
Was that the memorial to David?
Yeah, that was the David memorial where Kerry beat Ricky Flair. On that particular card, Kamala wrestled the great Kabuki that night also.
So you were there?
Oh, yeah, I was.
Okay, I've seen the tape. I hear you. You had to be at that show.
Yeah, they couldn't run without me. It would have been wrong, you know?
Well, what did you think about the Von Erichs?
It was a sad thing, my man. It was a sad thing. I believe it was too much too soon. You know, I mean, here are guys 19, 20, 21 years old that were working the wrestling before sellout crowds, people constantly telling them how wonderful they were. And they just took they made some really, really bad choices, you know. But they were great kids, and their father and mom did an excellent job. I hate it when people say it was Fritz's fault, you know, that these things happened to the kids. But I have a friend of mine that's a psychologist, and he told me that it is not that unusual when there is a suicide in a family that it can continue. It's an alternative to life. And by the kids continuously offing themselves, I guess that's the best way to say it, it made it an acceptable thing. It destroyed Fritz and Doris absolutely, completely. That, I mean, how would anyone feel to lose, they had six children and five of them died.
Yes.
Some by their own hand, not all, but some.
It's a tragedy life story, not necessarily a tragedy wrestling story, but it just so happened that it was in a family of wrestlers that loved it.
Yeah.
And we all grew up watching them, and that era was, just so much interest focused around Texas and focused around the Mid-South in general.
Well, I think Texas was the first place that they really revamped, as I said, with World Class TV. I mean, we gave you a close and personal look at wrestling rather than being set back where you wouldn't get any close-ups and you didn't get full sound. And I think the production helped as much as the wrestling because it was a totally new look.
And now And now I know you had a hand in that creative side.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Like I said, I was the booking agent for World Class for many years, and I brought a lot of my talent into this area over a period of time. I'm not saying I was the number one only guy. Bill Mercer had a lot of input, and also Mickey Grant, who is a film producer, and Continental Productions, TV 39.
Still active today?
Oh, yeah, TV 39 is still active today. Yeah, I don't know what exact wrestling's on there. Now, I watch Raw, and I watch Thunder. On Thursday night, SmackDown? And most of the wrestling now, it's hard to watch unless it's big-time wrestling. They have several shows here in the Dallas market, but it's mainly wrestling school guys imitating wrestlers, you know. So I only
they seem to be missing. We have the same thing in Mississippi, and I hear it from all over the country. I hear it from Dory Funk Sr. I hear it from Harley Race.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of the independents are missing the formula that was done so well in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And
well, let me tell you the reason why, okay?
Okay.
If you have a wrestling school, okay, or a wrestling camp or whatever you want to call it, and you charge a guy a phenomenal, ridiculous amount of money, don't make any difference if he's in condition, if he's fat, if he's skinny, if he's short, if he's tall, if he's sick or he's healthy, and you charge him weekly for you to teach him how to be a professional wrestler, if you want the money from the guy, you won't stretch him, you won't pound him, you won't kick him, and you won't hurt him. So therefore, you learn nothing. They come up with a silly name. They're more interested in the music and the jackets that they wear to the ring. They see a few power moves off of Vince's show, and they think that they're professional wrestlers. And they're not. It's a bunch of jokes. It's the worst thing that could possibly happen. Anybody that goes to a wrestling school that isn't a bona fide athlete on the way in has absolutely no chance. Stop and think how many guys have went to wrestling schools and how many wrestling schools there are. And I only know of one that has made it, and that's Steve Austin, but he was trained by Chris Adams.
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of a thing, you give me some money and I'll tell you wrestling's bullshit and get you a jacket and some music and you can be a wrestler too. But in fact, wrestling is not bullshit. Wrestling is very, very difficult to do and to do properly. You have to do it full contact. You've got to be in condition and you've got to love it and you have to accept the pain that goes along with it.
And you're so right. It is a dying art form. And if we don't get control of what's going on in the independent scene, it's going to go the way of the roller derby, it looks like to me, on the independent scene.
Well, the thing is, what are you going to do? I mean, if a kid comes up to an independent promoter and says, hey, I want to be a wrestler. Okay, give me $2,500. I'll make you a wrestler. That's like me going up to Jerry Jones and say, hey, man, I want to be a quarterback. He says, well, give me $2,500. I'll make you a quarterback. You can't take guys off the street and make them boxers or football players or anything. I mean, if it was fantasy wrestling, fine. But when you're telling the people that this is full contact wrestling, then you better have some guys that know how to wrestle, you know?
Yeah.
Know how to chain wrestle and know enough finish moves that they can try to beat you 10 or 15 different ways. It's the wrestling schools that have destroyed independent wrestling. That's my opinion.
Well, I agree totally with you. Now, you've seen the independent scene lately because of a connection you have with modern wrestling.
Yeah, my son, Chad. And I tell you, one of the most difficult things for me to do is to find quality opponents. A lot of times, we get very little money because I would prefer to pay his opponent much better than he's paid. But at least I know that he's having a competitive match with a real wrestler, and I won't allow him to wrestle with these wrestling school guys because it's a joke. I have a name to protect. protect, and he has a name that if he don't protect it, he'll never have an opportunity at big time wrestling. So,
and it's getting harder and few far in between to find those caliber opponents for him.
Well, the one good thing here about Texas, there are guys like Wild Bill Irwin, there are guys like Chris Adams, there are guys like Mike Davis, Tretch Phillips. There's a half a dozen guys. I bet my son has only wrestled maybe 24 guys in his, and he's been wrestling for 4 years, but I keep going back to those same 12 to 15 guys and telling the promoter, look, give him the money so it's worthwhile for him to come. And don't worry about Chad and I getting any money, because this is a training time for Chad to learn to wrestle real wrestlers. I mean, I would no more let Chad wrestle against some of these wrestling school guys. It's a joke and it's embarrassing. You know what I mean? I mean, for people to sit in the arena for 2.5 hours and end up seeing one or two matches that are actually competitive matches.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and that's why I started Mid-South Wrestling Memories. Mm-hmm. I actually promoted some shows, and I got to a point, and I said, something's wrong. We're not doing something right, and that's when I started talking to the legends, mm-hmm. Bill Watts being one of the first, and he told me, he said, buddy, number one, you're too honest, and you're too decent of a person to be in this business.
Oh, well, I think Bill sometime is a little bit of sour grapes on things. I don't know very many promoters that I work for that weren't honorable. There was a few that were thieves, but most of the promoters, they were pretty honest, honorable guys, you know?
Mm-hmm. And there's some real decent people trying to do the right thing.
Oh yeah.
And then there's a whole bunch that doesn't have a business stepping a foot in the ring. And that's what I learned from Bill Watts, and that's what I learned from watching World Class and Memphis Wrestling. You've got to be professional.
Yeah. Well, who do you think my son had his first match with? And I'll show you the difference in the way things are. My son's first match was against Greg the Hammer Valentine and Bob Arden. His second match was against Tretch Phillips. His third and fifth match, I believe, was against Wild Bill Irwin. And then he went through a series of matches with Mike Davis. So, you know, he's had the opportunity to wrestle guys that were in big time wrestling. We're in WWF and WCW and world class. So,
mm-hmm. Paid their dues.
Yeah, it's very hard now for a young guy, because if you don't have constant supervision and if you don't have direction, you know, you're just pissing in the wind.
Do a lot of people come to you for advice?
Yes, they do. And I do not give it, because I found a long time ago, you give them advice, and then you watch and see if they take the advice, and they don't. You know what I'm saying?
I think I do.
I try to, my whole thing, and to be honest with you, and I'm not bitter about wrestling, I loved my career, I had a wonderful time, I traveled all over the world. But I had a full cup. I mean, I started in 1960 in the Marigold Arena, and I finished in 98 in the Baltimore Coliseum in Baltimore. And I had a real full cup. And I have one son, Jason, that he wasn't interested in wrestling. He's in the radio business, which I'm very proud of him and very happy for him. My youngest son, Chad, he wanted to be in the wrestling business. And if it wasn't for him wanting to be a wrestler, no one would have ever seen me at an arena again the rest of my life.
So right now what's got you is your son's career, and you want to guide it and get it off on the right foot.
Well, I want
him to be commended, I tell you.
I want him to understand that wrestling is a business. It's a job. And if you're not really good at it, you're not going to advance. I mean, people all the time come to me and say, Gary, why isn't Chad in the WWF? I say, he's not ready for the WWF. He's 21 years old. He weighs 190 pounds. I sent him to Atlanta, my my good buddy Kevin Sullivan was one of the booking agents in Atlanta, and I called him and I said, how are you doing on cruiserweights? And he said, well, we can always use a couple of good cruiserweights. So because Kevin was a good friend of mine for many, many years, I said, okay, I'm going to send Chad to you. So here's Chad. He's weighing about 172 pounds, and who do they book him with? The Harris Boys. So I said, Kevin, what happened? I thought you were going to give my son an opportunity to develop a little bit. Oh, well, that was just a mistake. He said, we'll bring him back again. So I sent him back, I think, this time. First time he went to Philadelphia. The next time he went to somewhere up in North Dakota. I can't remember exactly where it was. And they booked him with a guy weighing 300 pounds. So Chad came home, and I said, son, I think it's better right now for us to back away from Atlanta and get you into a position where you can wrestle people that are more your size, you know?
Right.
Because it's hard for a young guy to, at 21 or 22 or 23 years old, to be 240 or 250 pounds unless he shoots his ass up with roids every day. And steroids, there's a place for steroids in athletics. I know a lot of people are going to be angry for me saying that, but it's a fact of life. But I don't think it's it has a place for a 21, 22-year-old kid. I think you ought to develop your base size that you're going to be. And then if you need a little help, I don't see too much wrong with that as long as you do it in a very, very conscious way that you don't abuse it, you know? So right now, he's, like I said, 190, and that's natural. Maybe as time goes by, if he don't get as big as he wants, then we'll talk about the other way, you know? I'm trying to be candid.
I hear you. And I tell you what, I want to follow up with this interview at a little later date with Chad and get some information from him, interview him.
Sure.
And at that time, this interview will be up on the internet with your pictures, and I'm going to do that for you, and then we'll link what Chad's doing right to your page.
Okay.
Where your interviews will be.
Okay.
And there's so much to talk about, and this is kind of the introductory thing between you and I.
Sure.
So we can, like I say, you know, get to know each other kind of thing. But I'm really, really mean what I say and say what I mean. There's a lot of people that looking back at the, you know, the memories right now.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stories that that we can talk about next time between you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And then along with Chad, to watch his career, to see, you know, see what a second generation wrestler has to really go through. That's going to be so interesting to see develop over the next 6 months, a year.
Well, the thing is, Chad has to earn what he gets, you know. I mean, his dad was a big name wrestler for many years, but that doesn't put one seat in the arena. I mean, a lot of times we go to these independent shows, and yeah, a lot of people turn out to see me, but before it's over, they come up to me and say, hey man, your kid is really good. We're glad we come to see you, but now that we saw him, the next time you're in town, we'll come and see him, which makes me feel very good.
Exactly. Well, look, it's been real wonderful talking to you.
Well, thank you very much.
And just like I figured, it was a great interview, and I'll be getting back with you and Chad, and we'll set that date and that time. So,
let me say one thing and go in, my man, okay?
Go ahead.
Don't forget the guys of today. Guys like Hunter Hearst Helmsley, guys like The Undertaker, guys like Kurt Angle. They could have hung with anybody of my generation. They are the best of the best, and I know a lot of times they're slighted, and I just think it's wrong. I'm the biggest fan ever of Hunter Hearst Helmsley. I think he's the best thing came down the pike.
I agree with you.
So all of them aren't bad, you know what I mean?
No, not on that level.
No.
And the names that you just mentioned,
yeah,
those are consummate professionals.
Yeah.
And it's fun, even to this day, watching. What I wish is that they'd come through Greenville, Greenwood, Jackson, Mississippi, and it's just a market that they're just not hitting. So.
Well, sometime, like you said, Vince has this developmental place there.
Yeah.
You might grab a shot of them occasionally.
Well, I'm trying to tagged my wagon to it. It's in Memphis. It's called Memphis Championship Wrestling. Yeah. He has 30 students, and I know most of them, and I see some real, real potential there.
Well, Lee, I don't think that you couldn't consider that a wrestling school organization. They're actually trying to develop talent for their business rather than taking money to train them, you know.
So well, they actually get paid a fairly decent salary.
That's what I want to make sure that there is a difference in that and also the wrestling school thing. That is not a wrestling school thing. That is a camp where guys are being trained by excellent wrestlers that make them pay the dues.
And what's so bad, Mr. Hart, is they really wish they could turn the clock back 15, 20 years and have some real big houses like we did in Greenville and Greenwood. Some of those houses are, you know, we're small in comparison, 800 people, you know, but that's what they need for these kids to be able to make that leap to WWF. They've got to do it in front of people.
Yeah, because if you need that crowd response. If you don't have that, then, you know, it gets pretty boring out there. For people to just to sit there and sit on their hands.
Well, that's the only way to learn it.
I do want to make a distinction. I don't consider guys like that wrestling school kids. I consider wrestling school kids somebody that goes up to a guy and gives him $2,500 and says, make me a wrestler. So I don't want your people that listen to think that I'm putting all of them in a group. There is a difference. Yeah. Like Chad was trained to be a professional wrestler. And I'm sure that the people in Memphis are training those young boys to be professional wrestlers. It's a big difference between that and your typical wrestling school.
Well, as a matter of fact, the trainer they got this week coming into Memphis is Dean Malenko.
There you go. See?
So, and he'll be there a whole week. So they get trained by the best.
Yes, they do, and that makes all the difference in the world.
All right. Well, okay. Nice talking to you, and we'll be getting back in touch with you here pretty soon.
Okay, my man.
Thank you.